The UN's climate change conference is going on in Poland. It could play a big role in how countries deal with greenhouse gas emissions. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the issue of climate, the Trump administration released the fourth National Climate Assessment late last month. The report was commissioned by Congress, compiled by hundreds of scientists across 13 federal agencies. We wanted to spend more time on the Midwest portion of the report. It warns that rising temperatures and more extreme weather patterns will have a devastating impact on our environment. Let's go to Barbara Mays Bousted. She's a meteorologist instructor for the National Weather Service, one of the authors on the Midwest chapter of the National Climate Assessment. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we dig into the findings of this 1,600-page report, can you help us understand what is the National Climate Assessment and what does it do?
The National Climate Assessment is a collection of the most updated research about climate change in different parts of the country and in different sectors of our economy and of our lives. Each chapter of it is written to be specific to a topic area or a region, and each chapter had somewhere around a dozen scientists working together to author it and to come up with the statements that are in it by consensus.
And then it is vetted by 13 federal departments?
It's vetted through departments as well as posted for a review to the public, who were welcome at the time to post comments and questions about the findings.
Well, let's get into the Midwest chapter. The Midwest is nicknamed the Grain Belt because of our agricultural region. What do we know about how climate change could impact food production and growing crops?
Our crops in this country are pretty heavily hybridized. So crop makers through the years have developed hybrids that have been adapted to the climates in which they're grown and in some cases to some stressors like drought. But what we're finding is that climate change is creating conditions and will continue to create conditions that won't be so favorable for agriculture where it's currently occurring. One good example of that is in temperature stress. As temperatures increase, it produces stress on our traditional crops like corn and soybeans. And unless the hybrids can also change as rapidly as the climate itself is changing, this will result in reduced yields.
There's also differences that we're going to see in the humidity. What does humidity, how does that impact our yields?
So humidity is a more complicated impact, but it still does have an impact. One thing that humidity can do is too much of it, a little bit like having a little bit too much moisture in your house, can create molds and degrade the condition of the crops. Too little humidity in the presence of droughts can, of course, stress the crops as well and create reduced yields. For the Midwest, we are looking for most of the region going a little toward the wetter side as climate changes. And that affects a lot of things, including when the crops are even planted. Mm. It's hard to plant when the fields are very wet, and if we increase that springtime moisture, it's hard to get the crops in the ground and get them in good condition and growing again for higher yields. And that increase in spring precipitation is one of the things that's projected to occur.
And farmers spend a lot of time and money fighting one of their worst enemies, which is insects. How can you explain to us why climate change increases the number of pests?
Sure. So in general, pests thrive in warmer environments than cooler ones, and they follow the warming, and some of them also follow the moisture as that range expands northwards. So what we are seeing and will continue to see is pests becoming more aggressive on their northern parts of the domain. They'll spread north, so pests that used to be perhaps native to Arkansas and Missouri may move northward into Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota over time. And these are pests that we aren't used to fighting in these areas. We aren't adapted yet to how to deal with them.
So we'll see different migration patterns with climate
Correct.
Change. Barbara Bousted is one author of the National Climate Assessment, as we talk about the findings as they pertain to us in the Midwest, looking at climate change. We're looking at transportation issues as well. Let's bring in Jennifer Jacobs, who is the lead author on the transportation chapter of the National Climate Assessment. She is a civil and environmental engineering professor at the University of New Hampshire. She directs the Infrastructure and Climate Network that's made up of dozens of scientists working on climate science and engineering research in the northeastern part of the U.S. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So we've been talking about warming temperatures, extending the growing season here in the Midwest, meaning we could perhaps produce more. If that happens, can our transportation infrastructure sustain more heavy use?
Well, as we start moving the growing season to a longer period and we start having higher volume and higher weight crops coming out of the northern part of the region, we are going to move the transport into highways from rails. And we know that anytime we put heavy vehicles and more heavy vehicles on a road network, it's going to create some damages and the potential for damages. So I think we've got some challenges.
Can you go a little bit more into how will the rising temperatures actually impact our roads and bridges?
Well, with roads, with rising temperatures, if you have an asphalt road, that's the black one, they get soft, and if they are softer, they can rut and they can get damaged. If we have the concrete ones, those are the white ones, if we get extreme temperatures, warming temperatures, they expand, and as they expand, they come together and they can actually pop, almost creating a super launch pad for vehicles.
And what about air travel and railways? Will climate change affect their functions?
Heat is a big one for both air travel and for railways. If we have extremely warm days with railways, the rails can buckle. Similarly for airports, the tarmacs and the lift that is available when we have extreme warm temperatures, those are the lift decreases. And so in some cases, airports get shut down when it's too warm. And that may not happen in Wisconsin. But these networks are so closely tied to each other that what happens in Phoenix matters in Chicago with the airports.
Oh, and you see this domino effect. When one goes down, you just see the ripple effect across the country.
Absolutely.
We are talking about the fourth National Climate Assessment, how it boils down, and that is the Earth is warming faster than at any time in human history, and we're causing it. We are poring over what this means in transportation and what happens to our climate in the Midwest. We're looking at the ripple effect on our economy, and we have two scientists who are with us. We have engineering professor Jennifer Jacobs from the University of New Hampshire. She is the lead author on the transportation chapter of this report. We have meteorologist instructor Barbara Mays Bousted, who is with the National Weather Service, where she worked on the Midwest chapter. You can join in with questions and thoughts on this report at 800-642-1234. Have you read the report? It's a lot in there, 1,600 pages. What do you make of the findings? What is troublesome to you? What do you want to get at? You can call in, you can email ideas@wpr.org. Perhaps you're a farmer and you're changing your business model as you see how climate change impacts your farm. Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back in a minute with more discussion on the National Climate Assessment here on the Ideas Network. Delegates from nearly 200 countries are in Poland for the UN's climate change talks. As this goes on, we're looking inward here to the Midwest and trying to get a better understanding of the National Climate Assessment that was released in late November. It is the morning show. I'm Kedar Cherkent. Midwest farmers will be challenged by warmer, wetter, and more humid weather that is brought on by climate change. And two scientists who worked on the National Climate Assessment are with us. Jennifer Jacobs teaches civil and environmental engineering at the University of New Hampshire. She was lead author on the transportation section. Barbara Mays Bousted is with the National Weather Service and contributed to the Midwest chapter. Getting your questions at 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer? Are you concerned about adapting crops to a changing Midwestern climate? What is your plan for sustainability? Perhaps you live near the Great Lakes. What concerns you about how climate change affects the Great Lakes? You can call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jennifer, going back to transportation, there's this push-pull, sort of a paradox, because it's affected by climate change, but cars and airplanes contribute to the problem. And we need transportation, though, in order to make everything work in our society. So how should we think about large-scale transportation and climate change working in concert with each other, but yet not contributing to the problem?
You just hit the crux of the problem right there. Right now, transportation is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases, and yet it is absolutely affected by the changing climate. I think there's a lot of things that we can do. Some of the challenges that we looked at in this chapter were how do we adapt, and how do we understand what our vulnerabilities are? And I think as we start understanding that the sector is highly vulnerable, we start also seeing that making smart decisions about our greenhouse gas emissions in the future is going to be one way to be able to help adapt in the future. And so we have a lot of options on there for the Midwest. Having a strong rail network to be able to transport agricultural goods is critical, because that uses considerably less energy than if we transport by freight, by trucks. Same thing if we can transport by barges, that's much more efficient for energy. So being able to make smart choices in how we use our energy.
Is it going to take a lot of smarter decisions, a lot of options that will need to be looked at and on the table? Because rail is one thing. Are there a lot of other things going on here?
There are a tremendous amount of things going on. It's a period of transformation for the transportation system. We have electric vehicles that are coming on. We have a very different mentality for the next generation of drivers. Many of them are not purchasing their own. They're using car sharing. And all these things are coming together to inform what our future looks like in the next 50 years. And it's really a wide open time for how the system's going to evolve and how it's ultimately going to play out with the car sharing and even the driverless vehicles. There are projections that it will significantly increase the amount of greenhouse gases to dramatically decrease. So it all depends upon how we deploy some of these new technologies.
Barbara, I want to bring you back in here. The climate assessment examines changes we're likely to see in our Midwestern forests. What's happening to some tree species as they respond to climate change?
A lot of ecosystems will be vulnerable to climate change, but forests have particular challenges. And one of those challenges is that forest species can't move as fast as the climate changes to get back to environments that are favorable for their growth again. So you can plant a tree in a new location that climate change has created temperature and moisture changes in, right? And that tree can grow and thrive. But for an entire forest to migrate and for a new ecosystem to develop where that tree species can thrive takes a long time. And the rate of climate change is outpacing how forests can adapt to that climate change. Trees are vulnerable because of the effects of both temperatures and moisture. Temperatures increasing makes some species not thrive as well. Some of the pine species, especially near the northern parts of our area. And other species require a lot of moisture, where a frequency of drought or hot and dry temperatures may affect their health too. And the downstream effects of that are substantial, because as trees grow and thrive or don't grow and thrive. Everything around them also depends on those trees, the animal species, birds and mammals and even insects that support and sustain those ecosystems are all affected by how the climate change is moving or changing the environment.
Something that comes to my mind's eye is when I've seen a new interstate built in Louisiana that cuts straight through a forest, like this very forested area. You remember the forested area, and suddenly it's clear cut and there's an interstate there. That must have repercussions as well.
Oh, certainly. And there's also, as you talked with Jennifer about in the transportation section, there's a feedback to this, too, that as we lose trees and tree species, whether we've cut them down or they just can't sustain healthy growth in a changing climate, trees are great absorbers of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And if we remove them, we remove a place where we can put that carbon dioxide back down into the ground. And with enough quantity, that makes our problem worse. Again, it reinforces this problem of too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Jennifer, the changing temperatures are also impacting the logging industry, and Wisconsin harvests most of its timber in the winter. So why does this industry depend on low temperatures?
Well, you're correct. The logging industry harvests about 40% of the trees during just that three-month winter season. So what's going on during the winter is that we get frozen ground. And when we get frozen ground, we have access to different areas, sometimes sensitive areas where if you had a wetland that you certainly couldn't go through during a period where it was not frozen, you're able to go through that area and to access it. But if we have warming winters, and we might not know it by looking outside today, but as our winters gradually warm, what we're seeing is more freeze and thaws during the winter season, which means we don't get those hard freezes that allow the forestry industry, the logging industry, to go in and access those stands. And so we're seeing a movement all across the country to thinking about how do we stop harvesting during the winter and move into summer production. So that's a dramatic shift, I think, that's on the horizon.
Something that jumped out to me, Jennifer, in the report is just how much more we're driving compared to 1960, a 250% increase on our roads in our personal transportation.
A lot of people, there's a lot of cars, and we depend heavily upon that. And so the culture for the U.S. is certainly very, very driver-centric. So, yes, that's choices that we are making in the U.S.
We're talking with Jennifer Jacobs, lead author of the transportation chapter of the National Climate Assessment, and Barbara Bousted, one of the authors of the Midwest chapter of the report. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. So Wisconsin relies on the Great Lakes. We use them for entertainment. We use them for tourism. We certainly use them in terms of industry and the fishing industry. Our economy is connected to them. Barbara, what impact will climate change have on the Great Lakes?
There is no doubt that climate change already is and will continue to have a substantial impact on the Great Lakes as well as the inland lakes that are surrounding the area. And that comes in two parts. First of all, the temperature changes themselves create a change in the zone where fish can thrive and be healthy. Cold water fish, for example, depend on a certain range of temperatures to be available for both winter and summer habitats. And as we warm, they lose some of that habitat. They get squeezed into a shallower layer of a lake. And if you squeeze a population like fish, then fewer of them can live and sustain in the smaller habitat area. And that's not even considering the problems of increased oxygen concentrations, and that also affects the area that's available for these fish to thrive. So we may be moving toward a climate where some of our cold water fish species cannot thrive in our lakes in the summer, some of the ones that are currently available. And boy, that's a hard hit for not only the fishing industry, but for the tourism industry that relies on people coming in and fishing.
We are looking at a 1,600-page report compiled by 13 government agencies, written collectively by hundreds of scientists. We're getting a better grasp of the national climate assessment, what it means for us living here in the Midwest. We have civil and environmental engineer Jennifer Jacobs. She's lead author on the transportation chapter. Meteorologist instructor Barbara Mays Bousted is here as well. She worked on the Midwest chapter. Your thoughts included 800-642-1234. If you read through the National Climate Assessment, what stuck out to you? What should we focus on changing as we handle the climate crisis? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. The United Nations 24th Climate Change Conference wraps up Friday in Poland with around 20,000 people in attendance from 190 countries, all looking to negotiate ways to slow down climate change. As these talks go on, we're taking a closer look at the National Climate Assessment here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The federal report emphasizes substantial damages to our economy, environment, human health, all happening because of a change in climate. And the Midwest is certainly not immune. We're zooming in on the Midwest chapter with meteorologist instructor Barbara Bousted of the National Weather Service. And we're looking at the transportation chapter with the help of engineering professor Jennifer Jacobs. Your insights are welcome, 800-642-1234. In your line of work, how is climate change forcing change on your industry? Are you already doing things differently due to a changing environment? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Kelly, who's joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Kelly. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm wondering how come all of the discussion around climate change seems to focus on how we can adapt to it rather than how can we stop it or even reverse it. It seems to me that if we can shoot a car into space, there should be somebody out there that could figure out how to reverse climate change. And then second of all, what can an average everyday person do to that end?
Well, Jennifer, let's start with you on Kelly's first question. Why our focus on what we're trying to do here? Why can't we find a solution?
So I think some of the conversation today is because we're talking about the National Climate Assessment, which really pushes on what's at risk, what are our challenges from a changing climate, and what have we seen. So that's the focus of that, of the report. Certainly there's a back and forth between our ability to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, as well as our ability to be able to adapt. So there are a lot of great minds and a lot of great thinking going on about how we do that. Some of it's really big changes, engineering, geoengineering. Some of it is everyday changes, changing behavior. Can you carpool? Can you reduce your footprint? And I think there's a lot of citizen groups that help us figure out what some of those best pathways are moving forward.
Barbara, your thoughts on what Kelly is asking here. How do we stop or reverse climate change when we have had such an innovative society we're living in? And then what can we do personally?
I want to echo Jennifer's comments that we focus on adaptation because we have stories out there that we can tell. Mitigation goes hand in hand, and mitigation is, of course, our efforts to reduce carbon dioxide, and it's also going to be a very important player in the health of our species and the health of our economy. So what can one person do? Well, the strength is in a community, and I would encourage you to find others in your community who are concerned and consider starting groups that suggest community action and build some support from the ground up. Within your own home, you can, as Jennifer said, use your car less and get a more efficient car. That is one of the biggest ways to have an impact on your carbon footprint. Fly less and take trains more, or carpool, or take buses. Simple things like, you know, driving. Oh, if you're going to go to the store and can take a bike instead of driving, then in some places that's not possible, but where it is, that's a helpful step. Recycling, changing your light bulbs to more efficient light bulbs. These things are small, and they sometimes feel small, but small changes can add up over time. And it's not just about changing that light bulb. It's about changing the culture and structure of how we use light, even. And it starts with changing that light bulb. So it feels like a small thing, but it builds up over time. And then the last one that I would recommend is meat is more carbon expensive than plants. I eat meat myself, and I'm not ready to go vegetarian completely, but being conscious of how much meat you eat and where it comes from is another step, too.
Barbara, let's break down human health for a moment. What about our own wellness? What does the report say about the impacts on human health?
You know, human health is not discussed, I feel, nearly as often as it should be, because the impacts are so very direct. As climate warms, it will have impacts on human health that are mostly negative. One example that stands out is with heat. Heat is hard to tolerate, and it's especially hard to tolerate for our most vulnerable populations, folks who are in poverty and can't afford or access air conditioning, the elderly, the sick, the children, and especially the youngest children and infants. You know, these are the folks who are most vulnerable to the heat and the ones who will suffer the most consequences as climate warms. And as our temperatures warm, they're not warming equally across all seasons or even all times of day. They're warming with the coldest temperatures first, so it's our nighttime temperatures that are warming quicker. And we think in the summer about heat waves and how hot the temperature's getting, but it's really the low temperature not getting cool that causes heat stress and heat problems.
Oh, because we don't cool down enough at night. There's still all of that heat radiating off of buildings, off of streets.
Yeah.
And it keeps it warm at night.
It does. And as we increase the moisture in our air, we tend to hold on to that heat at night a little bit more, too. And so we're not only hotter, we're more humid at night. And you just can't get the relief you need for your body to deal with that kind of heat. So heat stress is going to become a worse problem. But so are things like allergens and pollens and disease-carrying pests. And again, affecting the most vulnerable populations the worst. And how are we in our economies going to prepare to care for the health of those who are most vulnerable?
So Wisconsin had really intense rain and flooding over the past year, and the National Climate Assessment says we'll see more of this in the future. Let's look at flooding for a moment. How does flooding threaten human health?
Oh, flooding brings a range of problems itself. The floodwaters themselves are steeped in stuff we don't really want to talk about. There is everything from chemicals and oil and gas and spills to raw sewage in that water. And the exposure to what's in that floodwater can make people sick. It's one of the many reasons that we in meteorology encourage people to stay clear of floodwaters and don't get in them. So exposure to that floodwater certainly can cause health issues to not only humans, us, but also agriculture, farm animals, for example, not just in drowning them and causing fatalities, but their rotting bodies. Sorry for the very gross and graphic language this morning, but their rotting bodies also put hazardous materials in the water and carry diseases to each other and to humans as well.
Jennifer Jacobs, what about the impact of flooding on our transportation systems? How big of an effect is flooding to what we've built on our roads and tunnels and bridges?
Flooding is huge for the transportation system. This is one where it shuts down the system entirely if it gets flooded. And it's not just the interstates, it's the local roads as well. And if you think back to some of the most recent floods, maybe this past summer, this past spring, what you'll see with the pictures typically are flooded roads. And what does that mean? It means basically you can't get from point A to point B until those cones or that water recedes. So it's a huge challenge.
And water tables are higher, so the roads don't need to be covered or flooded to cause damage. Is that right?
I think that's one of the things that most people really don't understand, which is how a road's built. So roads were designed to stay dry, and if you have groundwater, water that's rising up close to the surface, it doesn't even have to hit the surface in order to be problematic. If we've got water close to the surface, it means that the road can't support nearly as much weight. And so, particularly for our local roads, if you put a heavy vehicle, an agricultural vehicle, on top of the roads when they are wet underneath, not necessarily flooded, what's going to happen is that road's going to start to break apart. And everyone's seen the alligatoring in the roads. In that case, we have a road that might have been designed to last 20 or 30 years, suddenly needing to be repaired after 2 or 3 years.
Because all of the equations were built for that road around a completely different environment.
Absolutely.
So give us some examples of how rural areas will struggle from climate change, Jennifer.
Rural areas are particularly challenged when any sort of extreme event comes through. Unlike a urban area that has a lot of resources, both financially as well as people resources to be able to repair damage, oftentimes a rural area takes much longer to recover from an event. And so rather than recovering after, say, a few months or even a year, it can take years for a small rural community to recover. And the other thing that happens in rural communities is that road network is so important to small businesses, to people that live there. And so that small businesses can't afford to be shut down for months at a time. And so sometimes we lose those businesses just because we don't have the road network to be able to support it.
Last year, the transportation sector added over $400 billion to the U.S. gross domestic product. It's a sector that is also very vulnerable to climate change, as we've been talking about, and contributing to the climate crisis. We're taking a look at the transportation portion of the latest federal report on climate change. Engineer Jennifer Jacobs, we've been talking with, and meteorologist Barbara Baustead stays with us. Your questions welcome, 800-642-1234. Do you drive cross-country? What do you see along the way that is an extension of climate change? Are you a farmer? Will you change your business plan to adjust to a changing climate? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation just ahead here on the Ideas Network. By design, the fourth National Climate Assessment doesn't offer policy recommendations. Instead, the 13 federal agencies and hundreds of authors provided the science. We're talking about two aspects of the federal climate report here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. We're looking at the impact of climate change on the Midwest and the impact on transportation. Our transportation system is rapidly growing and evolving in response to our demands. The report tells us that passenger miles traveled on highways have increased 250% since 1960, and that trend is expected to continue. Two scientists who worked on the National Climate Assessment stay with us. Jennifer Jacobs is an engineering professor at the University of New Hampshire. Barbara Baustead is a meteorologist instructor at the National Weather Service. Getting your thoughts, they're welcome, 800-642-1234. So what confuses you about this report? What questions do you have about a changing climate here in Wisconsin? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Carolyn now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead.
Hi. I live on a small dead-end street. In the 1980s, there were a couple of terraces where people had turned the grass into, one was a prairie, another was a food garden. And because backyards had quite a few trees around here, and more food gardens went in over the year, or over the years in the terraces. And a couple summers ago, my grandson came to visit, and he was so impressed with all the growth he saw here, all the green stuff. He made a yield sign. He made a triangular sign, and it said CO2 sinking with a Y, S-Y-N-C-I-N-G, in progress.
So, Carolyn, what have you seen over the decades happen to your dead-end street?
Well, it flooded this summer very badly, for one. But so did a whole lot of this area.
Have you seen the backyard gardens go away over time?
This was front yard gardens front. I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He said something about lawns are like food deserts for birds. And we've had birds. We've had lots of birds. It's sort of a bird sanctuary besides.
Well, let's get Barbara to jump in here. When we mow our lawns and we perhaps don't let them go to prairie grass, or we don't install that raised bed or vegetable garden in our backyards and front yards, what is the impact?
You know, we go back to our conversation a little earlier about the habitats becoming limited, and certainly the urban and suburban footprint is one of the things that has affected the ecosystems and the range of habitats of a good number of species, everything from butterflies to large mammals. And any steps we can take in our own yards to put that habitat back is helpful. It's best when a whole community can do it, because then you create a larger habitat and not a broken one. But you still create that space where that butterfly can stop over and pollinate, or that bird can nest and provide that habitat that they're losing. So I think it's wonderful to hear that communities or even streets are getting together to put that back on our ground.
Can one yard really make a difference?
If there's enough of them, absolutely. It takes one to, you know, it goes back to that culture change things. It takes one person doing it to say, hey, that looks like a good idea. Maybe I'll try it too. And maybe a couple more people start to do it, and you get a butterfly or two back that haven't really been passing through lately, and then you start to get the birds that accompany the butterflies for food, and you do start to build some habitat. It helps. Everything helps, at least a little.
Carolyn, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Tim now, joining us from Osseo. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I had heard that someone had said that the winters are getting warmer. Our experience here is that they're getting colder. And the reason I understand is that the global warming is melting the ice and heating up the increasing area of the water in the Arctic. That's forcing the jet stream south. And the more southerly jet stream brings us colder temperatures. That's what I hear, in a way,
Tim,
and what we're experiencing.
Yeah, Tim, thanks so much. And I want to get our meteorologist here to jump in here. Barbara, go ahead.
Sure. Wisconsin, like most of the rest of the northern part of the United States, is warming through the winter. It may not always feel like it because, of course, it's still winter, even in a warming world. Winters are going to have cold air outbreaks. It's going to snow in Wisconsin, perhaps not as often, but it's still going to snow. I am familiar with the research you were talking about, and there may be a connection between these Arctic patterns and the weather that comes into Wisconsin. But these will be interruptions that go on the cold and snowy side on the background of gradually warming temperatures. And although it's hard to feel it in February, it is a warmer climate than it used to be, and we're still going to get cold air outbreaks, and we're still going to get snow and storms, but not as often, and over time, less and less often. And should we not change our pathways, if we continue on the higher end of our carbon dioxide emissions, in the next 50 years or so, those will become much more rare to get the truly cold air outbreaks like we can get now, And we already aren't getting the very cold air outbreaks nearly as often as we used to, say, 50 to 100 years ago.
Tim, thanks for the call. Jennifer, the transportation chapter of the report says that engineers, planners, and researchers are developing plans to cope with climate change, but there are barriers to action. What is getting in the way?
Well, I think one of the big challenges is that when we make changes, we have to put resources towards these changes, and our transportation network is really challenged for resources. You probably have the same thing happening in your backyard that is happening all across the nation, which is it's a struggle to keep our existing transportation network running, let alone make it less vulnerable to future extremes.
Barbara, I want to let you jump in here as well. What barriers do you see moving forward on climate change, and from your perspective as a meteorologist?
So that is a great question, and most of our barriers are either personal or a bit societal. It's hard to change our habits. I'm a creature of habit, and you know I like to get up and have my cup of tea and drive to work. It's harder to think about getting on the bike and biking to work instead. It's hard to change what we do, and especially to make it a permanent change. But these are the kinds of changes that we'll all be looking at down the road to lessen the impacts of climate change. And certainly, we may be looking at changes whether we wanted to or not. If you're somebody, for example, who lives close to a waterway that's prone to flood, at some point, how many floods does it take until you're not comfortable living there anymore? These kinds of changes are very personal and very hard for one person and one family to do. Societal changes are hard, too, as we change the way we base our economy and change the way we look at our economy and start to consider the costs of what the carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. And the challenges are broad, and the opportunities are broad, too, though. And I don't want to harp on how hard it will be, because there will be opportunities for economic growth and improvement as well. Green energy is a great example of that as an area of emerging growth. Yeah, I think that probably picks up on my thoughts of what lies ahead.
And Jennifer, I'm going to give you the final word here. What message would you like people to take away from this gigantic report?
Well, I think the message of hope that over the past 5 to 6 years, we have really just absolutely grown as far as our understanding of vulnerability, our need to make changes, and our capacity to be able to do that. And so in a relatively short period of time, we've come a long way. And so we've always been able to address challenges that are faced to us. And I think we can move forward on this. We can move forward as a nation to be able to make progress. So I'm really optimistic that we can come together around this.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Jennifer Jacobs, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of New Hampshire, lead author on the transportation chapter. Barbara Mays-Bousted, a meteorologist instructor for the National Weather Service, author on the Midwest chapter. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.